London Column.
This is Peter Watson once again presenting a weekly radio digest of items headlined or modest, but all selected for your interest and entertainment from the worldwide services of the BBC. London Column. Today we bring you evidence of the solidarity of Britain in the face of threats to world peace. We bring you evidence of Anglo-American solidarity in common steps towards defence. And we show how one form of preparedness for a war now past can pay an unexpected dividend in 1951. The parliamentary system in Britain isn't always remembered as representing two official viewpoints, that of His Majesty's government and that of His Majesty's opposition, the latter essential to our democratic system. And since the visit to your president of the Prime Minister, Mr. Attlee, can perhaps give rise to the thought that, well, he can speak for one side, but where does the other side stand? We thought it would be helpful to bring you evidence of the solidarity of all Britons in matters of foreign policy, whatever their domestic politics may be. The Prime Minister, in fact, speaks on foreign affairs with all the nation behind him. And the proof lies in the foreign affairs debate in the House of Commons before his departure for Washington, and when Mr. Churchill voiced the feelings of the opposition concerning current world crises. In the chamber itself, microphones are not permitted to capture the living words as uttered, but our parliamentary correspondent brings us straight to the Churchillian viewpoint.
Mr. Churchill said that it should be our first objective not to separate ourselves in the slightest degree from the United States, in action or understanding or sympathy. The fundamental change in American policy after the war, her refusal to retire into isolation, was the best hope for the salvation of Christian civilization and democracy from communist and Russian conquest and control. We were certainly in danger, but the danger was not new. It could be seen in all its terrible potential from the moment the armies of democracy dispersed in the hour of victory, while the armies of the Soviet oligarchy were maintained at enormous strength. Mr. Churchill spoke of the expansion of Russian power and territory since the war, and said that they had gained control of half Europe and all China without losing a single Russian soldier. There were no signs that they were satisfied, and we could see no limits to their aims. But Mr. Churchill said it did not seem to be in the Russian interest to begin a major struggle now. In his opinion, a major attack by Russia in Europe was unlikely in the near future. It would not be provoked by the modest defense measure so far developed by the Atlantic and Western powers. He hoped there was still a breathing space for us to increase our defensive strength as a foundation for a policy of seeking understanding. But this might be a vain hope, and Mr. Churchill said he was in favor of seeking a settlement with Russia when a suitable opportunity arose. But while the immense superiority of the United States Atomic Bomb Organization offset the Soviet predominance in every other military aspect, this superiority allowed us to talk with the Russians in a friendly and dignified manner, and at least as equals. He hoped that when a conference took place, it would be conducted not as in the past, in the glare of publicity, but in privacy and even in secret, and at the highest level. Speaking of Korea, Mr. Churchill said he did not see that events in the Far East should make Russia in a hurry to change her policy of expansion by means of the Cold War and of using others to advance her aims. The United Nations should do everything possible to avoid becoming inextricably involved in a war with China, which would prevent the reinforcement of Europe. The defense of free Europe against possible aggression is not just a blueprint. It's a matter of real and lively activity. And that's shown in the heartwarming fact that for some time now, American flyers have been training in Britain. Within the training program of the Royal Air Force, the 20th Fighter Bomber Group of the United States Air Force has its established place. Continual flow of men passing through the group on a training course extending over several months. To Manston Airfield in Kent, where the 20th are stationed, we sent our air correspondent for you. And the first person Charles Gardner heard from was the group's commanding officer, Colonel John Dunning from Texas.
We've had fine training in the British methods of flying, to include considerable weather flying. We've also had RAF affiliation, which has given us a comparison between pilots and equipment. We were fortunate to take part in the late Emperor exercise, wherein we had an opportunity to fight with and against all types of airplanes.
Colonel, during these exercises you've had, have you been flying, as it were, side by side with the RAF in any exercises? That is, as one formation, some of them American, some British, or you've been operating separately?
We did that as well as operating separately. We had formations on escort with bombers, and RAF gave us top cover in some instances, and in other instances we had to fight against the RAF, which was most interesting.
Would you like to give any comment on the result?
No, thank you.
One of Colonel Dunning's squadrons is the 55th.
Says its CO, Lieutenant Colonel Billy Mitchell Jr., a relative of the great Billy Mitchell.
The 55th, he says, admits that there are other squadrons, but he doesn't quite see why. The youngest pilot recruit to the tradition of the 55th is Second Lieutenant Clemens, still in his teens.
What kind of exercises and work have you been specializing in?
We've done all manner of work with bombers. We've had escort, interception. We've done low-level fighter sweeps. And we've been doing everything. Anything you might name, we've had a crack at it.
Well, there can't be many legacies of global warfare that are worth preserving at all, and certainly even fewer that can make a really useful contribution to the days of peace. But among the few must certainly be counted London's deep shelters, those backwaters of the London Tube Railways, 60 or more feet underground, that found themselves turned into bomb-proof bed and breakfast hotels for thousands of Londoners threatened with Hitler's bombs. When the final all-clear came, most of the bunks were torn out of these deep shelters, but not at Clapham, a few miles from the West End, near one of London's great parklands. And having been developed since into one of the biggest hostels in Europe, the Clapham Deep Shelter will really come into its own next year, to accommodate some of the less well-off among the thousands coming to London for the Festival of Britain. We asked our reporter Audrey Russell to see how the plan was working out, especially the prices.
The charge will be 3 shillings a night, with a deposit or booking fee of 6 pence a head beforehand. Bookings can be made for one night only, or up to 7 nights, for organised parties with a responsible person in charge. The authorities will not, I'm told, be able to cope with a stray individual who turns up at the last minute looking for a bed. It's primarily for parties of 20 or upwards. From the early inquiries and bookings, it's obvious that the parties will be a great deal larger than that. Accommodation has been booked for 1,500 schoolgirls for one night, and another party of 2,000 visitors has already made plans to come to London and stay in the shelter sometime in May. The shelter, which is deep underground, well below the tube trains, can provide sleeping accommodation for about 4,000 people at one time. It's lighted by electricity, which will be dimmed in the sleeping quarters at night. These are equipped with two-tier bunks that are set out like a crocodile along the quarter-of-a-mile-long tunnels. Each bunk has a mattress with a washable white cover and 3 blankets. A top sheet is provided as a special concession to the women. As you walk along the arched corridors with steel-reinforced sides, it gives one the impression of being below decks in a big ship, or possibly in a giant elongated Nissen hut painted white. The ventilation is controlled by 4 25-horsepower electric installations, and it was as fresh as a room at ground level when I was there today. There are no less than 8 canteens in the shelter. Up to date, these have been able to provide tea and sandwiches and cakes, but visitors to Clapham during the festival will be able to get an early morning meal before they set out for their tours of sightseeing, and an evening meal at night when they return.
For our postscript from London columnist Alan Melville.
Alan? This is Alan Melville speaking. Mr. Attlee decides to visit President Truman. President Truman says yes, by all means, delighted to see you. Mr. Attlee boards a plane, and in less time than it takes to say unilateral coordination, President and Prime Minister are together and down to business. President Truman decides to have a man-to-man talk with General MacArthur. Within a few hours, they are thrashing things out together in a hut on Wake Island. Progress, that is. The surging onward march of civilization. or is it? I don't know.
I merely pose the question. Was the world a better behaved and better run spot in the days when it took weeks instead of hours to travel from England to America by steam packet or sailing ship? Were allies any less securely bound together in the days when communication between them was by sail or stagecoach or runners? Don't ask me, I don't know. Of course, on the face of it, it's an excellent thing for the leaders of nations to be able to get together at the shortest possible notice whenever they deem it necessary. Unfortunately, the great majority of them only seem to deem it necessary in times of crisis when the urgency of the situation compels a get-together. I sometimes wish they would hop into planes and nip off to have a good look round other people's countries and a good talk to other people's citizens at times when things are calm and normal and when it's possible to read the headlines in the morning papers without a momentary shudder. But then, you rightly point out, when in this highly civilized, streamlined 20th century have things been calm and normal? When has there not been at least one minor shudder among the headlines? Too true. We live today, of course, at far too fast a tempo. The leisurely days of cogitation and rumination and let's just think this one over are gone. There's no time to think things over. They are over almost as soon as they're thought of. A military situation can change overnight from good to bad, as in Korea. A nation can strike in a matter of seconds where once months were involved. Nowadays, there's no time even for that quaint, outmoded courtesy of declaring war. There's no time to think properly. And so the harassed leaders of nations must pair in high-powered cars to board high-speed airliners to take part in high-pressure conferences with their opposite numbers, must confer with the urgency of the situation spurring them on and hurrying them up, must dash home or on to new landing grounds to put their snap judgments into speedy practice. Even in the last few years, the tempo has increased. In Churchill's current volume of war memoirs, there are pleasant little sidelights on one of the meetings between himself and President Roosevelt, of FDR settling down at Shangri-La for 3 hours with his stamp collection, of the two leaders unsuccessfully angling for trout in a nearby stream, while the rest of the silly world went rushing on in its usual abominable hurry. Today, of course, you can't waste time over a stamp collection or a brown speckled trout. The urgency is too great for such dalliance. There is very little time to act, and hardly any to think. Progress, that is. Goodbye.
Thank you, Alan. And it's goodbye, too, from this edition of London Column, which came to you in the North American service of the BBC.
That was London Column, a transcribed program.
This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.